Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling McKee v. Cosby, that 2019 defamation case. Now, on the surface, it might seem like just another celebrity lawsuit, but it actually cracks open a really significant discussion about how defamation law works, or perhaps should work, you know, especially when public figures are involved.
Absolutely.
We've pulled together a range of sources, court documents, legal commentaries, even some thoughts from Justice Thomas himself. And our mission is to make sense of why this particular case is still being talked about, not just in Hollywood, but in legal circles, and what it might tell us about the future of free speech.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What makes McKee v. Cosby so compelling for you listening is that even though the Supreme Court didn't take up the full appeal, Justice Thomas's separate opinion really throws a wrench in the established understanding of defamation law concerning public figures.
Right.
He directly challenges the New York Times v. Sullivan precedent, which, you know, has been a cornerstone for decades. So our goal today is to navigate this case, understand the intricacies of defamation law for those in the public eye, and explore the potential for some pretty significant shifts in this legal landscape.
Okay, so let's lay the groundwork with the facts. This all started back in 2014 when Catherine McKee publicly accused Bill Cosby of a serious crime, a rape she said occurred way back in the 1970s.
Yeah.
This wasn't a private accusation. She shared her story directly with the New York Daily News.
And the response from Cosby's team was swift. His lawyer sent a letter to the Daily News. Now, this is a really key point for you to note. This letter was explicitly marked confidential.
Confidential, right.
In it, the lawyer demanded a retraction of McKee's allegations and went on to pretty aggressively attack her credibility, calling her claims fantastical and even referencing her career in adult films.
Right. And you'd assume a confidential letter stays that way, but in today's media environment, that's often not the case.
Not at all.
It was leaked, and suddenly it was being reported everywhere. The Hollywood Reporter, various news outlets picked it up and ran with it. Feeling that her reputation had been damaged by the contents of this leaked letter, McKee then sued Cosby for defamation.
Which brings us to how the legal process unfolded. The initial court, the district court, actually dismissed McKee's case. That decision was then upheld by the First Circuit Court of Appeals. Ultimately, the Supreme Court declined to grant what's called certiorari, essentially. They decided not to hear her appeal. So on the surface, it looks like a definitive end to McKee's legal challenge.
But as you pointed out, here's where it gets really interesting for us. Even though the Supreme Court decided not to hear the full case, Justice Clarence Thomas issued what's known as a concurring opinion.
That's the key part.
Now, a concurring opinion means he agreed with the court's decision not to hear the appeal, but he wrote separately to explain his own distinct reasoning and, well, concerns about the underlying legal principles.
Exactly. And the central legal questions in this case revolved around two main points. First, the courts had to determine whether Catherine McKee qualified as a public figure under the law.
Okay.
Second, they had to decide whether Cosby's legal team acted with what's legally defined as actual malice when they wrote and, you know, when that letter was leaked and subsequently published.
And that term actual malice is absolutely crucial to understanding these kinds of cases, isn't it?
Definitely.
It all stems from that really significant Supreme Court case, New York Times v. Sullivan. For anyone listening who might be newer to this, can you give us a quick rundown of what Sullivan established?
Certainly. New York Times v. Sullivan, decided back in 1964, established a very high bar for public officials initially who sue for defamation.
Right. Officials first.
They can't just prove that a statement was false and damaging to their reputation. Instead, they have to prove actual malice. Legally speaking, this means demonstrating that the person who made the statement knew it was false or acted with what's called reckless disregard for whether it was true or not.
So, like, they didn't care if it was true or false?
Pretty much. Or they had serious doubts. The fundamental idea behind this high standard was to safeguard robust public debate on matters of public concern, even if that meant allowing for some factual errors when discussing public officials, protecting speech, basically.
And in the McKee v. Cosby situation, how did the courts apply that framework to her? She wasn't an elected official.
Right. Well, the courts classified McKee as what they called a limited purpose public figure. This concept developed in later cases, most notably Gertz v. Welch.
Okay, Gertz.
The reasoning here was that by voluntarily stepping into a national controversy specifically, by publicly making those very serious accusations against Bill Cosby, a major public figure, she had intentionally thrust herself into the public spotlight regarding that particular issue.
So even though she might not be a celebrity in the traditional sense.
Exactly. Her actions put her in the position of a public figure for the limited purpose of this controversy.
So because she was deemed a public figure, even a limited one, she then had to clear that much higher hurdle of proving actual malice in her defamation lawsuit against Cosby. It raises the stakes significantly, doesn't it?
Precisely. And this is the crucial juncture where Justice Thomas's concurring opinion carries so much weight. While he agreed with the Supreme Court's decision not to hear McKee's specific appeal, he used his opinion as a platform to directly challenge the Sullivan precedent itself.
Yeah, he's essentially saying, I agree with the outcome here, but I think the underlying legal framework we're using is, well, it's flawed.
That's it, exactly.
Okay, so let's dig into his argument. What exactly is his issue with Sullivan? Why does he believe it was wrongly decided?
Justice Thomas approaches this from a legal philosophy known as originalism. For you to understand this, it means he believes we should interpret the Constitution based on its original meaning at the time it was adopted.
Back in the 1700s.
Right. In this context, he looked back to the legal landscape in 1791 when the First Amendment was ratified. His analysis of historical legal practices suggested that at that time, the common law of libel allowed public figures to sue for defamation without necessarily having to prove this element of malice.
Huh. So no actual malice requirement back then, he argues.
According to his reading of history, no. He views the Sullivan rule as a more recent policy-driven decision by the court in 1964, one that wasn't actually rooted in the original understanding of the Constitution.
So if I'm understanding correctly, he's arguing that the Supreme Court in Sullivan was essentially making a judgment call based on what they thought was good policy for the time protecting debate, rather than strictly interpreting the Constitution as it was originally intended to be understood.
That's the core of his critique. He argues that the authority to strike a balance between protecting free speech and safeguarding individuals from reputational harm should primarily reside with the individual states, rather than the federal courts imposing a uniform national standard like the actual malice rule.
Let the states decide.
He believes the states are perfectly capable of determining that balance for themselves, based on their own laws and the will of their citizens.
And he explicitly stated that, didn't he? You mentioned a specific quote.
Yes, he wrote, "The states are perfectly capable of striking an acceptable balance without federal meddling."
Federal meddling. Strong words.
It really encapsulates his fundamental belief that the Sullivan decision overstepped the Supreme Court's role and inappropriately interfered with the state's traditional authority in this area of law, which is libel.
So the really big question that emerges from all of this is, could this concurring opinion from a sitting Supreme Court justice signal a future reevaluation, perhaps even a potential overturning, of this very longstanding and influential New York Times v. Sullivan precedent? It feels like a legal earthquake could be brewing.
It's certainly a significant possibility to consider, although it's not an immediate certainty, of course. A concurring opinion, while influential, doesn't change the existing law.
Right, it's just one justice's view.
But it does indicate that at least one current justice on the Supreme Court holds a fundamental disagreement with a long-established precedent and believes it needs to be revisited. If other justices were to adopt a similar viewpoint in future cases that directly challenge Sullivan, then yes, we could indeed witness a really significant shift in defamation law in this country.
With potentially wide-ranging implications.
Absolutely.
Let's take a step back and revisit the key legal principles that were at play in McKee v. Cosby and their broader impact. We've talked about Sullivan and the actual malice standard for public officials. Then Gertz v. Welch expanded that to these limited-purpose public figures. What was the original reasoning behind these rulings? Why make it so challenging for public figures to win defamation cases in the first place?
Well, the foundational rationale behind these rulings was to foster what the courts hoped would be a truly robust and uninhibited public discourse on matters of public concern.
Free speech, basically.
Yeah, the idea was that if public figures, who often possess greater access to media outlets to defend themselves and their reputations anyway, could too easily file and win defamation lawsuits, it might lead to a chilling effect on critical reporting and commentary regarding their actions, their policies, their character.
So reporters might hold back for fear of being sued.
Exactly. The court aimed to create a sort of breathing room for the press and for citizens to engage in open and often vigorous debate on important issues, even if that might occasionally result in some factual errors along the way.
Right. So in the specific context of the McKee v. Cosby case, the courts ultimately concluded that because she voluntarily stepped into the public arena by making those accusations against a prominent public figure, She then had to meet that very demanding legal threshold of proving actual malice. And why was she ultimately unable to do that in this case?
Well, the Kurtz reasoned that Cosby's lawyer, in sending that letter, had a First Amendment right to vigorously defend his client against McKee's very public accusations.
Okay, defense is protected speech, too.
To an extent. Furthermore, the statements contained within that letter were largely viewed by the courts as either expressions of opinion, for example, calling her claims fantastical.
Which isn't usually defamation.
Correct.
Yeah.
Or as being based on information that was already part of the public record, such as details about McKee's previous career.
Yeah.
Under established defamation law, opinions and even truthful statements that might be unflattering generally don't provide grounds for a successful defamation claim.
So even if it hurt her reputation, if it was opinion or based on public facts?
It's generally not defamation. Crucially, McKee couldn't provide sufficient evidence to demonstrate that Cosby's lawyer knew the statements in the letter were false at the time he made them, or that he acted with a reckless disregard for whether they were true or false.
Hmm.
She couldn't meet that high actual malice standard.
So the overall significance of this case, even though the Supreme Court didn't fully hear it, is that it really reinforces just how difficult it remains for individuals deemed to be public figures to succeed in defamation lawsuits under our current legal system.
Mm-hmm.
But then, as we've discussed, Justice Thomas's concurring opinion throws a significant curveball, questioning the very basis of this established precedent, suggesting that this area of free speech law might be far from settled.
Absolutely. And there are some really critical nuances within this case and the broader legal landscape that are worth highlighting for you. First, this concept of the limited purpose public figure.
Yeah, that seems key.
It's essential to understand that even a single deliberate act of injecting yourself into a public controversy, like McKee's decision to speak publicly, can be sufficient to earn you this legal classification and all the significant legal hurdles that come along with it in a defamation lawsuit.
Wow, one act. And the definition of actual malice is another really key point that often gets misunderstood, right? It's not simply about someone having bad intentions or a general ill will towards another person.
No, not at all. It's a very specific legal term. It requires demonstrating either a knowing falsehood, meaning the person knew what they were saying was false, or a reckless disregard for the truth, such as consciously ignoring clear evidence that their statement was incorrect. It's about the speaker's state of mind concerning the truth.
Got it. Much more specific than just malice in the everyday sense.
Exactly. And then we have this really fundamental contrast in legal philosophy between Justice Thomas's originalist approach and the more modern balancing approach that the Supreme Court adopted in the Sullivan decision.
History versus modern policy needs.
Sort of. Justice Thomas is looking back to what he believes was the historical understanding of the First Amendment's protections, while the Sullivan decision was an attempt by the court in the mid-20th century to strike a balance between the constitutional guarantee of free speech and the legitimate need to protect individuals from unwarranted harm to their reputations in a rapidly changing media environment.
And finally, the issue of the confidentiality of that letter adds a really interesting layer to this whole situation, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely.
It was initially intended as a private communication between Cosby's legal team and the Daily News, yet its subsequent leak and widespread publication ultimately formed the primary basis of McKee's public defamation claim.
It really highlights how easily private communications can become public in our contemporary media landscape.
And the significant potential legal ramifications that can follow.
Yeah, it absolutely does. It effectively transformed what might have remained a private legal strategy into a widely disseminated public statement, which then became the central subject of the defamation lawsuit. It underscores the complexities of navigating reputation in the digital age.
So to really bring it all together for you, the core takeaway from McKee v. Cosby, even without a full Supreme Court hearing, is that it powerfully illustrates the substantial legal hurdles that public figures face when attempting to sue for defamation in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The New York Times v. Sullivan precedent and its stringent actual malice requirement create a very, very high bar to clear.
And just as importantly, Justice Thomas's concurring opinion in this case represents a really significant challenge to that very foundational legal principle. It clearly signals that this area of law, which many might have previously considered well established, is in fact subject to ongoing debate at the highest levels of the judiciary.
Yeah.
And could potentially undergo some fairly major shifts in the legal landscape in the years to come.
That's a truly thought-provoking point to conclude on. So for you listening, here's a question to really consider after our deep dive today. Given Justice Thomas's compelling argument about the original meaning and intent of the First Amendment, how might defamation law in the United States be fundamentally different if that actual malice standard, as established in New York Times v. Sullivan, were to be overturned or even significantly modified?
Big question.
What would be the far-reaching implications of such a change, not only for individuals who operate in the public eye, but also for the news media that reports on them, and ultimately for the nature of public discourse itself? It's certainly a lot to think about. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us today.
Thanks for listening.
We'll be back with another fascinating case next time.